Welcome to Berkeland Insights and the last episode of our podcast series on lessons learned from the last downturn. This is a series of podcasts that we're doing with key executives and experts that have been around before and have had major crisis moments in their business careers with the intent of trying to learn how they managed it and what they did. Joining us today is Mike Kaswan. Mike is one of Berkeland's most experienced CFOs. He has decades of experience as an entrepreneur and C-suite executive in startups and growth companies. He has strong healthcare experience and is very adept at the kind of high-level and forward-thinking, see-around-corners type of work that is the hallmark of a really good strategic CFO. So we wanted to catch up with Mike today and talk a little bit further about what he learned in the last crises he's managed through and what CEOs and business people can learn in order to navigate the current one we're in. Hi, Mike. Thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, Steve.
So, you know, you were on the firing lines, as I was, for at least one of the last existential once-in-a-lifetime crises that we seem to be having every 10 years or so. Can you go back to one of them that really sticks out in your mind and paint the picture for us? What was the scene? What were you doing? How had the company been impacted by a crisis? And what was your role there? And what did you start needing to think differently about?
Yeah, so I mean, I've been through a few of these, as you said, 9/11, the global financial crisis, and now this one are the three that sort of stick out. And, you know, going back to the financial crisis in sort of 09, you know, I'd been at which was a healthcare private equity venture capital firm for about 13 years. We were on SecBac, which have now gotten popular again.
Right.
And we had raised $130 million, successful IPO, and even had a target signed up, and all hell broke loose and the markets crashed. And, you know, despite our best efforts, it became clear you just could not close a deal in that environment. Investors right. were running for the hills. SPACs were actually one of the few things they could still get their money out of. It made it impossible to consummate a deal. I mean, luckily for the investors, they were made whole. It was one of the only things they actually could get their money out of and get 100 cents on the dollar. But for us as a SPAC team, you know, it was just not an environment in which we could complete a deal. But, you know, we also had, you know, a bunch of portfolio companies still. And, you know, stepping back and looking at it now, I mean, to me, and one of these days I'll be wrong, but I've always taken the approach that when it gets really bad, it's never as bad as you think. And it always comes back to the mean at some point. And the key is just to be around when it does. So.
Right. Right.
You know, the companies that were living on the edge and didn't have cash or didn't adjust or were poorly run or didn't have a real business didn't survive. But
right.
the good companies made it through, in a lot of cases, made it through stronger and found themselves in an environment maybe with fewer competitors, easier to differentiate what was real, and sort of took off from there. And that's one of my big takeaways. I think we're even seeing it now in this one that, you yeah. know, at the bottom, it feels like you're going to continue to go through the floor and it's never going to come back. And, you know, here we are sitting today, the stock market's almost all the way back to where it was before this all happened. And venture money is flowing again. You know, the economy is still a mess, but, you know, the market mm-hmm. would tell you people think it's going to be okay.
Seeing through the valley, right? They're seeing across to the other side.
Yeah, I think it's a horrible thing, especially from sort of a social health,
right.
people who've had the disease. But I think, you know, as we've learned over and over, our economy tends to be more resilient than people think when things are bad and does come back.
Yeah, but I think, you know, the two maxims that kind of all stand out is your ability to manage through an emergency is usually a function of how well you prepared for it in the first place, right? And to the extent this crisis has been an accelerant, like you said, a lot of companies found out that they weren't really managed right in the first place, or maybe they didn't really have a business. And this accelerates that whole thing. The pressure pushes those folks to the sides. When you yeah. when you look at those prior experiences, other than the healthcare portion of it, which I don't want to minimize, like you said, it's horrific. But what stands out, like maybe macro or economically, or you mentioned the investors before, what stands out to you about this one compared to maybe the 08 crisis, which, or even 9/11? 9/11 being an event-driven one, I mean, this is kind of a longer-running event, but it's still very event-driven versus a systemic thing. What stands out? What are the differences?
Yeah, so to me, this one feels a lot more like 9/11, in which it was an event-driven thing. It was not primarily about the economy, although obviously people worried about the impacts on the economy. And a lot of it was just around fear, confidence, are things ever going to get back to normal? And even things like, you know, I lived in New York City during 9/11, and you heard tons of people say, I'm moving out and I'm never coming back.
Right, right.
But they all came back. And it feels the same now. I mean, you know, we're now in the suburbs, but lots of our friends and family were in the city, and they've all sort of retreated out to their Hamptons houses or suburbs or wherever if they could. And they're saying they might not go back, but I guess we'll see. You know, things tend to go back normal and people tend to forget how bad it seemed at the time. And the things that attracted them there in the first place are sort of still there. And I think that's true of the economy. It's true of the markets. And so, you know, I think that's what we saw with 9/11. I'm hoping that's what we'll see again with this. The financial crisis was a little different because I think you really had fundamental economic financial system issues at work there.
Dislocations. Yeah.
But even that, everything came back and sort of settled back in and kind of got back to business as usual. I think to me, that one felt riskier. This one feels like at some point we'll have a vaccine and this will go away. And though it doesn't ever seem like we're going to be normal and be shaking hands and going inside other people's houses again, a year from now, we probably will.
We probably will be, yeah.
This will all be, you know, a bad memory. And, you know, one of the things that is, in a way, encouraging is I think you've seen a lot of companies that this created opportunities for.
Yep.
I mean, so in my world, you know, digital health probably advanced 5 or 7 years ahead of where it was trending, because all of a sudden, the idea of telemedicine and virtual visits and all these things. Now it's okay. Now people are, you know, insurance companies and Medicare are paying for them. And I don't know that people will necessarily go back. I think people are realizing, hey, for a lot of stuff, that's good enough. And why do I need to sit in my doctor's when I could just do a quick Zoom in 20 minutes? They could tell me I'm fine or just go pick up an antibiotic. And so I think, you know, you could look at that, all this work from home stuff. I think people are realizing that works a lot better than maybe they had feared.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's whole new business models. And again, I think it speaks to the dynamism of our economy. Mm-hmm. Crisis breeds opportunity, and any problem is an opportunity to create a fix for it. So we've seen some really amazing actions where, you know, either new companies have started or other companies that had started but hadn't really quite caught on are going nuts now because they have an answer. And so the fact that even something as bad as COVID, we can actually solve with the dynamism of the capitalist and entrepreneurial economy, to me is, you know, gives me optimism of the future. You know, you don't want to be the guy who just opened your new restaurant or hotel, or, you know, you don't want to be an airline executive right now. But, you know, in the macro scheme of things, overall, there'll be a shift and some companies will suffer, but lots of companies will do well. And
like you said, this is the event-driven equivalent of a 9/11, but the tail is very long. So the consequences are long. You'll see the ability to hold your breath until that sort of normal activity returns or in some form returns will be a really important marker, right? Guys that have cash, guys that have got the ability to hold their breath, hunker down, you know, go from, like you said, in a restaurant, really popular restaurant, is able to shift to online delivery or whatever, is going to have a better shot of it, of a person that never thought about that before the day they had to shut their business down.
I think in these things, you know, it's really important to not underreact, but also not overreact. You know, it's, I think it speaks to, you know, some people can do that on their own, but it's also useful to have advisors, whether that's your board, whether that's other on your management team, whether that's a good strategic CFO,
right,
who could sort of take a little bit of an outside view, maybe a little bit further, you know, from the situation and give you a sense of, yeah, thinking about this correctly, or gee, you're being a little aggressive here. Maybe you ought to manage as if it might take 6 months to get back to normal or 12 months and make sure you can make it that far. Or, hey, you're in a really good position and now is your chance to go grab market share or
go buy a competitor.
Buy a competitor, seize some opportunity because you're now markedly stronger than everybody else and, you know, the market is lined up for you. So I think that's really key. The people who get hurt are the people who either think, A, this is fine and it's going to be back to normal in a month, or, you know, the people who say, I'm firing everybody and not doing anything and it's never coming back. So trying to balance sort of being around and surviving, but still with an eye towards making your business successful and taking advantage of whatever opportunities present. That seems to be the trick, and you know, easier said than done. But I think if you have some advisors and help, on your people who can help you, that's probably useful.
So when you go back to like 9/11 or even the global financial crisis in 08, and you were sitting there in that seat back then without the benefit of the knowledge that you have since built, where did you see not only maybe your own management team, you know, sort of needing to learn on the go, and other than what you just said about, you know, don't overreact and don't underreact, how does a CEO in a startup business right now, you know, I know the investors play a role in this, we'll talk about that in a minute, but the world afield of them looks different than it did in January. And enterprising young CFO is looking at that world in much the same way we just described it. They are terrified on one side and they know there's opportunity on the other. When they look at taking risk, again, put yourself back in the 2001 when you were running this thing, how would you have done that? What would you like to go back and say to yourself back then? Hey, look, you're spending a lot of time worrying about this. Don't worry about this. You need to be worrying over here. Anything like that come to mind?
I mean, I don't know about looking back personally, but in general, I think a thread that I've seen over my career from having been entrepreneur, CEO, investor, CFO, is the companies that have been most successful at weathering these storms over-communicate and set the right expectations. So that's both internally with the team. So, you know, whatever concerns or fears you have as a CEO is going to be multiplied through the rest of your team because you at least have some control over where things are going.
You get to
the
make
rest
the
of your team, you know, they're worried, do I have a job? Is the company going to be in business? So you really have to over communicate to your team to keep them on board, make sure they know you're on top of things and have a plan and that the company's going to be around. But you also have to be realistic, right? So if you just sort of seem Pollyanna-ish, like everything's great, then you're going to lose credibility.
They're not going to.
And it's the same with your board and investors, right? So I think one of the challenges always with entrepreneurs is you wouldn't be an entrepreneur unless you were an optimist and you believed you could succeed and overcome the odds that are stacked against you.
Right.
But there's a fine line between that and being totally unrealistic and not seeing the world as it is. And so navigating that and giving your investors and board and employees confidence that, hey, you're in charge, you're going to lead them through the storm, but you're not the captain of the Titanic thinking we can't sink and we'll just crush through these icebergs.
What iceberg? Right.
Is critical. So, I mean, I've seen a lot of times when the CEO feels like, gee, I can't share bags with my board. I can't seem like I'm worried about anything, or they're going to fire me, or they're not going to invest. And I think that's totally the wrong mindset. I think, you know, if the board and your investors once in a while hear bad news or hear about the challenges, they're going to think you're hiding stuff from them. Either you're hiding stuff from them or you're totally clueless. And
you're tone deaf, right?
As a board member and an investor, that is way more scary than somebody telling you, I have this problem, I have that problem, I have the other problem.
Right.
When you feel like the CEO is not telling you what's going on, anything could be going on and you're just waiting for the shoe to drop. So my biggest piece of advice, probably always, but even more so in a crisis when your investors are also skittish, is for communicate.
Yep.
You know, it's setting those expectations, right? So
it's,
hey, here's where we are. This is what's happening to us because of the crisis. It set our plan back 6 months, this, that, the other. And here's how we're going to deal with it. And then they have confidence and they can get behind that. And maybe it means the next round is not the up round you wanted. And maybe it means you're not going public this year. But if they feel like you're in charge and have a plan, they'll stay behind you and you'll be one of the survivors. If they feel like you're just open for a lottery ticket to bail you out because you're afraid to tell them what's really going on, then
that's not
going to
help. It'll make the conversation harder. I was reading a thing the other day that talked about the fact that while CEOs are also going through this inaugural crisis in their careers in many cases, the same is true for a lot of investors, right? There's a whole generation of younger VCs out there and they haven't done this yet either. How would you contrast the way you interacted with your investors? You know, taking a riff from what you just said about the communication, do you think there's also the opportunity for CEOs to kind of craft the relationship and help their investors understand their businesses really well through a crisis like this?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's probably true. There are a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of money raised for venture and early stage investing over the last 5 years. So I've been through this before. So, you know, to the extent you have a seasoned CEO or team that has been, I think, you know, again, giving some comfort and some guidance to those investors and just being a steady, you know, steady hand in the storm, if you will. Because it always feels like whatever trajectory you're on is going to go on forever. So things are going well. You think, hey, it's good times are never going to end. And when things are going bad, everything's going down the turlet.
It's always worse than it is. Yeah.
Trees don't grow to the sky. And you have to realize that it's probably not as good as it seems in the great times. And it's probably not as bad as it seems in the bad times. Mm-hmm. And you know, if you're still around at the end, when the music stops and you got a chair,
then you won.
You're probably going to be okay.
I've done that in my own career too. Is saying, okay, reset my expectations a little bit here. If I come out of this flat, it's a win, right? Yeah, and like you said, making sure everybody's on the same page with you. That, look, guys, I know we wanted to triple this year. Well, you know what? If we all still have a roof over our heads and we are flat from last year, that's a home run, and we'll rebuild from there. And not beat yourself up as a CEO if that doesn't, you know, stay on track to what you had pre-crisis.
Absolutely. I mean, you take two of the same companies that both said they were going to triple this year, and the CEO that goes and resets the expectation with the board that says, hey, I think we're going to be flat, and they come in 20% ahead of last year, they're a hero. The guy who goes back and says, you know what, I think we can still triple, double. And they come back 20% ahead of last year, and they're worried about
their abject failure.
Yeah. They're the GOAT, right? So it is all about setting expectations and then exceeding those expectations. And, you know, in some ways, you know, I definitely have seen companies that were maybe out over their skis, and this is giving them the opportunity to reset and be able to blame it on COVID and some other things, even if it wasn't entirely because of that, and say, all right, you know, we're going to clean the slate a little bit and start over, and we can say it was because of COVID and maybe get back onto a positive track.
I've seen in this crisis in particular, more mature companies have been able to do that when they have, you know, a rationalization or a riff that they really needed to do internally anyway, and they've just been avoiding it, and they didn't want to have the difficult conversation with the person who's been with them for many years and hasn't really been pulling their weight a whole lot. It does offer, it sounds really cold-blooded to think of it this way, but it does offer an avenue to be able to do a reduction in force and get the right people in the right seats using the crisis as sort of your overlay, because it's not wrong that you need to do it. But like you said, you probably needed to do it before too. It just wasn't hurting as badly. Now it is.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I think, look, it's just mad that not every hire is going to be a great hire and not every employee is going to be a great employee. And the reality is, you know, if you took the emotion and the fact that we all want to do right by our teams and our friends and our employees, you know, every company should probably cut the bottom 10 or 20% every year. I think people don't do that because it's just not nice and you get a bad reputation. But you're right. This is an opportunity to maybe freshen up the team, get out some of the low performers without necessarily getting the blame that you're a bad person for doing that, and upgrade. And at the other end, I think it's also a great recruiting opportunity if you are one of the survivors where, you know, maybe you couldn't get some of those top people before because people were throwing money and options or they wouldn't leave their company.
Stupid deals,
now, all of a sudden, you know, the markets come back a little and maybe you can afford them, or maybe their current company is having problems. And so, again, I think if you're in a position where you can play a little bit of offense, now is a great time to do it.
Yeah, that's a great segue into the risk question, right? So how does a crisis shape a person's, a CEO's perception of risk? Like you're saying, you know, trees don't grow to the sky. When everything's great, it feels like everything's going to stay great. And so we're sometimes a little bit more emboldened and we make dumb decisions. Do you think, though, like you were saying, the pendulum goes strong the other way? Does a CEO face the possibility of of not taking enough risk right now because they are so cowed and worried. Like, let's talk about that for a little bit. Like, risk to me, especially if we're, knock on wood, beginning to see the end or at least a pathway into a more sustainable period of normalcy with this risk, with this crisis. How should CEOs begin indexing the amount of risk that they should be comfortable taking, risk going to their board, you know, double down on the investments, all that sort of stuff? What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, again, like I said before, I think it's just as important not to overreact as underreact. And so I think a couple of things you can do is one is just take a look. You know, at the end of the day, the biggest thing is don't run out of money, right? So a business can survive anything except running out of money, right? Maybe a government investigation. Right. But so the first thing is to take a real look at, okay, let's say it is worse than I think. Can I survive and how long can I survive? So if you've got 3 months of cash in the bank, then you shouldn't really be taking any risks. You should be thinking about how do I get more money in here or how do I extend my runway? If you have 2 years of cash in the bank, then I think you're in a pretty good spot to be aggressive.
You roll the dice a little bit.
Yeah, that's sort of the first thing is it's almost like the stress testing of the banks, right? So if everything goes against me, can I survive? And what does it take to put me out? And if you feel like, gee, the probability of the doomsday scenario is pretty small, that's the first sign that, hey, maybe you could take a little more risk. And then the other thing is, I think, just a realistic assessment of where you are and what your market position is. Mm-hmm. And in some cases, it's probably riskier not to be aggressive, right? So if you're Instacart at the beginning of this and you say, well, gee, I'm not going to go hire thousands of people because, you know, that's super expensive and I'm not... Well, all of a sudden, nobody's going to use your service anymore if you can't deliver anything. And this was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
You missed this golden opportunity. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. So sometimes the risk is in not acting when you need to, because all of a sudden you become irrelevant when you had your chance to really be a critical company, you know, serve a critical need to your customers. So I think you just got to have a realistic assessment of where you are. And I think, you know, one of the important things is just don't do it yourself. You know, talk to as many people, smart people, people who've been through things like this before, people outside your company looking at it and outside in, and just get a lot of opinions from people you respect that know what they're doing. Then you probably can triangulate and say, gee, how I see the world seems to be fairly accurate based on, you know, the 10 trusted people I spoke to, or...
Right.
Wow, at least eight of the 10 says, right. Yeah, 8 out of the 10 think I'm crazy. Maybe I ought to reassess.
And I know in other lives, you know, the adage of go left or go right, but move when the ground has shifted, move. Because there's going to be good stuff that happens from that. I think you're right, too, in the part about the communication. Like if you are looking at, okay, I got 2 years of cash and I'm Instacart and I can sense that this is going to be a once in a lifetime thing, then get on the horn with those guys. Get the capital you need. Like they're... If you're talking to them a lot, they're gonna bank you. They're gonna support you as a CEO trying to take advantage of it, making lemonade out of lemons, right?
You know, one of the reasons that I think things do tend to come back maybe faster and better than people assume is there is an upward bias in all these markets. I mean, there's a ton of money that's been raised for startups. There's a ton of money in the markets. There's just a ton of money out there that all wants to go up. So they're looking for excuses to buy. They're looking for excuses to invest. Nobody is sitting at a venture fund going, I just raised $500 million and gee, the world looks kind of scary. I'm going to put it in
5-year CD.
Yeah, no, they're going, oh my goodness, how do I get this money out and still
working?
Get my management fee and my carried interest and how do I take advantage of this? So people are still going to want to find good investment to back, even in a tough scenario, in a tough environment. And I think the people who've been through it a bunch, you know, some of the investors that I talk to feel like there's a positive in that, hey, maybe this resets valuations a little bit. Maybe this resets expectations and terms. Mm-hmm. And maybe we got a little ahead of ourselves because there was so much money and so many new investors. And I was having to take a little more risk than I wanted to. You know, maybe now I have time to do my diligence on a deal and I don't have to try to close in 2 weeks because it's super competitive, or I can pay a reasonable valuation that doesn't valuations need to be a unicorn stupid. For me to make any money. And I can get reasonable protections around my, you know, my investment in terms that are sort of, I used to be standard, that maybe have gotten away. So, you know, to some extent, it's also just a reset of markets that maybe did get a little too frothy and did need something. I mean, preferably it wouldn't have been hundreds of thousands of people getting sick and dying. But, you know, I think most investors would have said, hey, it was getting a little frothy. And the idea that some external event resets a little bit is probably not an overall bad thing.
No wrong thing, You know, and too, I think for CEOs, it's important to realize that it's okay to go and talk to your board about raising additional money if you've got a good plan for it, right? It kind of loops back to that, you know, have the experts with you that you think are going to help you understand, okay, best case scenario, worst case scenario, middle scenario, so you can go to them. Don't be afraid to ask, because like you just said, their alternative right now is a 0.6 10-year treasury note. There's not a lot of alternative out there. And so they are looking for places to put the money. And if you have a good story and they believe in you as a CEO, go have that conversation with them. Now's the time.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And one of my pet peeves has always been, you know, entrepreneurs or founders or CEOs who are overly concerned with valuation or dilution or what's it going to look like if my next round isn't at this month. None of it matters till the end. And, you know, the key is build a great company, get the money you need to do that. And if that comes at a flat round or a down round or an up round, it's sort of worth the matter. I know it feels bad. So the guy who did your last round at $2 a share isn't going to love that you're raising money at $1.50. But at the end of the day, they're really not going to like it when you run out of money or when you didn't capitalize on your opportunity.
Right.
And particularly as a management team, this is probably not what the investors want to hear. Any good investor is going to take care of you, meaning they're going to top up your option pool. They're going to make sure you have an incentive and are motivated. So if you have to go raise that round and you dilute yourself, most likely they're going to say, well, gee, we have to keep, you know, the CEO incentivized. Here's some more options and we'll take it out of the old investors. And, but even setting all that aside, you have to just try to do what's right for the business and build a great company and get the money you need. And valuation will take care of itself in the end. And you do that, you'll be worth a lot of money and everyone will be happy.
Right. If it gets to 15, no one cares.
Your B price was a little bit lower than your A price and wasn't four times. That all gets forgotten when, you know, everybody makes a bunch of money. So try to not get too caught up in putting your self value based on whether or not you did an up round and what the multiple of your last round was. All of that stuff is totally irrelevant until you sell or go public.
Continuing on that line of thinking, what would be your line of advice to help a CEO kind of stay sane through all of this stuff? You know, don't be so hard on yourself and understand there's bigger factors here. Like you say, stick to your knitting. I know that, you know, our own experience and those of the clients that we work with, these folks often feel like they're carrying the weight of the world on their shoulders. And a lot of times their VC investors are more than happy for them to think that way because, you know, that they feel that it keeps their nose to the grindstone better and all that in a regular environment. But what would you want to have them hear from someone who's been there, done that, and knows what the other side looks like?
And one of the things that I think is, you know, being an entrepreneur or being a founder can be a very lonely business and you can feel like it's all on you. So one thing that helps is to have a team that you feel you can share the load with, ideally co-founder or at least senior people on your team that, you know, you can sit around and can help you solve problems and reset expectations and pick you up when you're down and you pick them up when they're down. Ideally, you have a board and investor group that is also supportive like that. And you can have those kind of conversations with and not have to worry, well, gee, I can't tell them I'm worried about this.
I can't say that,
Weak or, you know, I'm going to scare them. You know, good investors know every company has ups and downs and challenges and problems, and they're there to help you solve it and help you get through it. And they also know that no CEO is perfect, has done everything for, and people love to be helpful or feel needed.
Right.
So, you know, ask them for help, ask them for their advice, you know, let them be a mentor. And then they're going to be much more invested in your success than if you take the attitude like, oh, I have to show them to do everything and I don't want to ask for help and that's going to make me look weak. Well, sooner or later when you need it, you probably will look weak because they're going to be like, where were you for the last 5 years? Now all of a sudden you can't handle it. You should have kept us in the loop. You should have brought us along. So again, I think it all comes back to communication and managing expectations and then sharing the load And to some extent, you know, I also think it helps to just sometimes step away from it and have some balance and have, take a vacation, spend some time with your family, get your mind off of it, do something other than 24/7 worrying about your business.
Sweat and, the business. Yeah. That's a really good point.
I mean, you know, there's always way more to do than you have time to do it, even if you are working 100 hours a week. So at some point you have to be able to say, gee, I'm just not going to be able to do everything. These are the critical things I need to do. And it's just as important to keep myself mentally and physically in good shape for the business. And you need to be able to delegate. You need to be able to prioritize. Your not to-do list is as important as your to-do list, maybe even more important at that level.
Yep.
And, you know, keep yourself strong because everyone else is going to rely on you to set the example and your leadership and climb on your back. And the more humble and realistic and just sort of emotionally stable you could be during that, the greater the odds of success.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you, I think if too, you take the attitude, like, I got to be the hero, good luck, it may work, but you may also find yourself not able to carry that load because it's a
right,
big load
and
to
you
carry.
Break down.
Or too much to expect for most people.
Yep. My own experience, like, it's easy as the CEO to now in the crisis get drawn even deeper into the weeds because you feel like you've got to overmanage everything, right? It's actually the time to get up out of there and stay focused on, you know, you don't want to be tying down the deck chairs and forget about the iceberg. You know,
exactly.
You've got people who can do the tying down of the chairs. You need to worry about where the iceberg is. It's happening now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, A, the rest of your team, as much as you may be inclined to say, I'm going to hide the reality from them and put on the brave face, they know more than you
they
think
know.
They do.
Yeah, 100%.
And if they see you doing that, they're going to lose confidence. And on the flip side, if you go to them and say, hey, guys, here's our situation. Here's the challenges we have. I need help. You will be surprised at how they rally to the cause, at least the good ones. And the ones that don't are probably not the right people. And this is a good time to find that out.
And how good they are at doing what you need them to do without you needing to help. You don't need to hover over them. You know, like that's the thing I'm seeing in some cases now where the intensity of the crisis has the CEO like opening the door for the customers in the morning. You know, like you should not be doing that. Think
through. Yeah. And one of the great things having been a CEO is watching people succeed on what you might have thought, right?
Right.
So people who step up to the challenge, but can't do that if you don't give them the opportunity.
Yep.
So not only will you be surprised by the results you sometimes get, and not only do you get to offload some of the stuff, just the satisfaction of somebody that has never done something before doing it and succeeding at it.
And you're like, wow,
seeing themselves in a whole new light and opening up their potential. I mean, it's interesting because you go to business school and you take finance and you take leadership and you don't, as a CEO, it's all HR and it's sales, which are the two things they don't teach you in business school. And so you realize your time is really about how do I assemble the right team? How do I motivate that team? How do I get the right people in the right seats? And giving people the opportunity to succeed and feeling like you're rooting for them and you're helping them and you want to give them those opportunities and make them successful does wonders for a company culture, and those people will be loyal to you forever.
Those are exactly right. Those are the guys that are going to manage
your calls. That's what makes the best companies when they're filled with people like that. Yeah. Not, oh, we have this brilliant CEO and I'm going to let him or her do this because they're much smarter than me.
Than me. Yeah.
The problems are just too big for one person, no matter how good you are. So,
right. And all of that,
you know, get your team on board.
Yep.
Absolutely. And people are, you know, I think you're surprised at how other people respond. You know, you think, well, I'm the CEO. I'm the only one who's going to work crazy hours or go above and beyond. But if you ask your team, you'll find most of those people are happy to do that.
Yeah,
if they're committed to the cause and they believe in what you guys are doing and they respect you. You can't require them to work all weekend necessarily. But if you say, gee, I really need help with this, people are going to want to step up and help, and they might do it themselves just because they're committed to you, they're committed to the cause, they're committed to the team, and that's how you get through it. Succeed.
Old leadership maxim from General Patton in the old days, he would say, don't tell people how to do their jobs. Tell them what you want done, and they'll surprise you with their ingenuity. That about wraps it up. I think it's a good place to stop there. And Mike, thanks again for helping out with this series and joining us. This has been the final episode of Berkman's Lessons from the Downturn podcast series. We're looking forward to doing a lot more of these. And Mike, we'd love to have you back if you'd be so inclined for the next one.
Absolutely. This was fun. Thanks, Steve.